morning. This is the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. Today we are meeting for a commutation phase one hearing for Mr. Richard Chrisman, and his ADC number is listed as 287097. According to information that's been presented to the board, and before I do that, I want to introduce you to the board members and at this time. And before I do that, if there is an attorney or attorneys representing Mr. Chrisman, we would ask that you might want to sit up here if there are attorneys representing Mr. Chrisman, and if there are attorneys representing the state or the victim, we would ask them to sit over here just for, as a courtesy. It's not necessary for them to do that. If they wish to sit up, then we welcome them to sit up front. So we're going to move forward. As I was saying, first of all, welcome to the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency this morning. As you can see, there are four board members participating in this hearing today. And they are the Honorable Mr. David Neal, to my left, your right, the Honorable Mr. Louis Kawanis, to my right, your left, the Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse is also to his right. My name is C.T. Wright. I'm serving as board chair as well as panel chair this morning for this hearing. Just a couple of things that I would like to just point out, that this board always, and anything that it is involved in wants to be professional and fair. And that's part of what we do. We know that sometimes decisions are not easy to make, but that's what we're always attempting to do. As I've indicated, that this is a phase one hearing. And in phase one commutation hearing, and in phase one, the board places a great deal of emphasis on whether the sentence was excessive or if there is something that was not available to the court at the time of the sentencing. In phase one, we're not interested in, you know, how great a job he's doing, and we certainly appreciate this wonderful package that has been presented to the board. We're not interested in what he might be doing when he's released. But right now, we're going to make a determination whether to move him to phase two, based mainly, not totally, but mainly on whether the sentence was excessive and is there something that the court overlooked. And we're going to ask that you would respect that. That's our policy. If we move to phase two, and that would be the vote of this board this morning, if the board sees fit to move to phase two, then at that point, we need to know everything about him. He's doing a great job while he's incarcerated. He has a great family out there. He's doing just the best of everything. You would tell the board that in phase two, so that the board could make an informed decision. Now for phase one, it's limited. Phase two, whatever you want to tell the board, those great things. And in phase two, we'll be able to see him on the video. Phase one, we do not see him. We will not see him today on the video. It will just be those of us in the room today talking to each other, and you're talking to the board. If after phase two, which would be scheduled at another date, not today, phase two, we don't go into phase two today if the board moves in that direction. At the end of phase two, if we go into phase two, it's at that point that this board would make a recommendation to the governor. And it is the governor's decision to commute the sentence, not this board. The board will only make a recommendation to the governor. The governor does not have to honor that recommendation. That's left up to the good graces of the governor's office. And I just wanted to put that on record so that we all would be saying the same thing and have the same understanding today. I would point out the fact, just for the record, we do have lots and lots of letters, lots and lots of documentation that's been presented to the board. These board members have had an opportunity to review and to gain an understanding of everything that has been presented to them. And I want to thank those who put these packages together, these documents together for the board, and the board has reviewed all of them. Now, I do take note that we do have a number of supporters present today, and I don't know whether the victims have arrived or not, but I do take note that we have a number of supporters present today. And I don't know how many and wish to speak. Let me just ask this, how many of you plan to speak today? Just by hand. Okay, so we have, okay, all of you are going to speak today, okay. So I'm going to, except for the attorneys, or attorney, except for them, I'm going to ask that board member, I mean that supporters and victims would limit their comments and not repeat what has already been stated, because we do have a number of other hearings today. Therefore, we want to use our time judiciously rather than just going on and on. And once we go through this process, and this process is going to be at the beginning, we will give the attorney for the offender an opportunity to come forward and speak. Then we will give supporters of the offender an opportunity to speak. If we're going to ask the supporters to limit their comments to 2 or 3 minutes. Following the supporters, then we will offer an opportunity for the victims to come forward and speak if they are present. That will be followed by giving the opportunity for the state, the county attorney, or anybody else here representing the state an opportunity to speak. Then we will bring the start bringing the hearing close to an end. We will give the opportunity again for the attorney to speak. Then the board will begin to have a discussion, and following that discussion, the board will make a decision. Let me just say this, and I know that all of you already know this, but I just want to be, I'm very elementary in terms of my thinking. The board will, for the first time, after we listen to everybody today, after reviewing all of these documents, for the first time, these four board members will discuss this case. We've not discussed it in the past because we operate under the open meeting laws of the state of Arizona, and we must do everything in public. We do not go back in a little room. We do not go into a jury room or a judge's room or no other type room. We must do it up here. And this will be our opportunity at that point to talk to each other, make a decision at that point, and based upon a vote, that will be what the decision of this board will be. So we just wanted to make sure that we all understand that we have not had an opportunity to discuss this with anyone. My final statement, opening statement, would be, as you all know, now this is not a trial. We're not judges. Neither one of us is a lawyer. Therefore, we are citizens. We will make a determination based upon the information presented to the board. So at this time, unless I have a board member who wishes to make a statement for clarification purposes, we will move forward with this commutation phase one hearing. And hearing nothing from board members at this time, we're going to see who wants to come up first. And I see you're already on your way up, so please come forward, ma'am. And sorry to keep you standing so long.
No,
I apologize for that. And first of all, would you state your name for the record, ma'am?
Good morning. My name is Julieta Castles. That's C-A-S-S-E-L-S. I am the attorney for Richard Chrisman. I was retained by the family and colleagues about 18 months ago or so in an effort to present these materials to the board here today. And so we are thankful for your time. We are thankful for the consideration that you will give all of these items. Richard Chrisman is clearly a special inmate. He is, as a former police officer, under a much different housing situation than any other inmate in the state of Arizona. For those reasons, I am asking the board, given that this is a public hearing, to carefully protect Mr. Chrisman's location That location is not published on the AZDOC website. It is not known to the public. So I would just ask for the board's consideration of that matter, given that his safety is all of our primary concern. Today I have with me, I don't even know how many, a large number of supporters here, some of whom will be addressing you. I would like you to know that there are many, many more who are not in attendance today, who also wanted to speak out regarding the severity of the sentence that has been imposed for Richard. I think that there are two main components to this severity argument. The media, almost every day, reports about officer-involved shootings. There have been national reports constantly about officer-involved shootings. We know, just from our everyday lives and reading the news, most officers are not prosecuted. I put together a comparative analysis of cases within Maricopa County and Arizona for all of your consideration. That information was updated last week with the most currently available public information. You will see I have two pages of a chart. There is one individual who has been prosecuted, brought to trial, and convicted, and that is Mr. Chrisman. The other officer out of Mesa, his trial was scheduled to begin 2 days ago. I'm not aware of whether that trial has actually gone forward or not. It is extremely unusual in this sort of a situation that charges would be brought. I submitted a public records request to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office requesting information on all referrals for our police officers to that agency. I received extreme resistance to that and in fact was told to take the matter to Mr. Montgomery, the county attorney himself. I was told the information was voluminous. It had already been a matter of several months when I made that request that I was not getting responses. In speaking with Mr. Chrisman and with the family and friends that are here today, we decided to move forward without that information. However, it is clear from the review of documents which are publicly available, the vast majority of officers involved in a situation like this are never brought charges. Also included in your materials is a letter written by the Honorable Judge Granville. Judge Granville presided over the trial. He was also the judge who ultimately accepted the agreement and did the sentencing. As Judge Granville notes, had he been able to impose less time, he would have. Mandatory sentencing in Arizona, however, provides it's an absolute minimum of 7 years for this nature of an offense. The county attorney, Mr. Juan Martinez, was unwilling to make any other offer that may be probation eligible, that may have less time at stake. Mr. Chrisman was presented with the plea offer, basically during a break, told sign it or not, we're going back into trial. Mr. Chrisman did what he thought was ultimately best for his family, and he found himself really struggling with that decision every day for the last 4 or so years. As Judge Granville also wrote, it is extremely unusual that he would write this type of a letter. When I approached him about it, he immediately indicated that he would. He, of course, remembered Mr. Chrisman's case well, and he remembered specifically things that he had said without having to refer to his own transcripts about the case and about the sentence that he wished he could have imposed. I think this is crucial. This is very uncommon, and I think that the statement from the judge, who had the opportunity to hear all of the testimony and preside over the case for a series of years, I think he has a unique perspective. Judge Granville, of course, has also been on the criminal bench for many, many, many years and has sentenced thousands and thousands of individuals. This is unique. The second component in this, I believe, is the nature of Mr. Crispin's incarceration, as I mentioned before, is different than any other inmate in Arizona. Because of his status as a police officer, he is in extreme levels of danger. When he was remanded into custody, he was forced to be put into extreme protective custody. In the time since his sentence, he has done a huge amount of time, almost 2 years, in isolation. He eventually was moved out of state. he remains in protective custody out of state. Every day that he is serving is a very difficult, difficult day where he is concerned for his safety. He is concerned that other inmates may learn, that even staff at the facility may learn. It is critically important that his safety be maintained. Also, because he is in a different jurisdiction, the regular Department of Correction rules do not apply to him. He is not allowed to have contact visits. He is not allowed to perform any off-campus work, despite the fact that the facility would love for him to do so because of his qualifications and his public service background. Every day that he serves is much longer than an average inmate day, where they're able to associate with other inmates and work and do off-campus projects. Mr. Christmas' sentence of 7 years isn't a true 7 years. It is incredibly difficult. His family is driving for hours to go see him, only to be able to see him through glass. And yet, his wife has continued to do so. He's out of touch with his local friends. I am asking the board to consider, first of all, the treatment of other officers involved in officer-involved shootings, the mere fact that Richard was prosecuted, let alone convicted, the fact that Judge Granville himself, who sentenced Richard, believes that the sentence was too harsh and would have given him less if he had legally been allowed to under the law, and that the conditions which Mr. Christman are serving under are also extreme. With that, I will cede the floor to a number of the supporters who are here. As noted in the packet, which I provided to you all about a week ago, we have signatures from a sizable number of police department officials. There are many, many others who are not here today, who did not sign, who did not write a letter, out of fear for their own position, but who, behind the scenes, are very much in support. Large number of law enforcement here present today to support Mr. Christman as well. So, with that, I will cede the floor. Thank you.
Before you cede the floor, ma'am, let me ask my board members if they have any questions for you at this time. Any questions, board members? Honorable Mr. Kalanis.
Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman. Can you hear me clearly? Because sometimes we have some microphone issues. Can you hear me in the rear? Thank you. Thank you for acknowledging. Ma'am, just have one cold legal question. We see a high volume of plea agreements and sentencing. In this case, it was for manslaughter, a Class 2 dangerous felony, correct?
Correct.
So was there no mechanism for mitigating or aggravating factors in this particular charge?
Judge Granville sentenced Richard to the minimum term available under the plea. When a plea offer is extended by the state, it is a take it or leave it situation. If the judge were to have done something different, say he said, no, I don't believe that 7 is appropriate, I want to give him 3 or probation or what have you. At that point, the state can withdraw from the plea and the matter can proceed back to trial. So when a prosecutor makes a plea offer, and the case law is clear on this, that plea offers, if extended, are in the sole discretion of the county attorney's office. We're stuck with what we get.
I guess what I was asking was, for this particular charge, I've seen charges where, and I'll just say X charge, and we'll say a mitigating, a presumptive, a minimum, a maximum, and an aggravated. In this case, it always seems to have minimum, presumptive, and maximum.
Correct, and that is the difference in the sentencing scheme for Arizona. Dangerous crimes only have the presumptive, the minimum, and the maximum.
That's what I was looking for. I do recognize he was given the minimum. All I'm saying is I was trying to get my arms around why there was no mitigated or aggravating.
Non-dangerous offenses have the 5 different tiers.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions, board members? Any further questions from Ms. Rittenhouse?
No, sir.
Mr. Neal? At this time, we have no further questions at this time. But I would point out, just for the record, as has already been stated, that Mr. Christman is serving, technically, has 2 offenses. One is manslaughter, which has already been stated, and he was sentenced to 7 years. He's requesting a reduction in sentence of 2 years, 5 months. The second one was for aggravated assault, which was a 5-year sentence. and he is, I believe, requesting the same reduction, and we do have the years and times that he would be reduced. I just wanted to put that on record, and both the manslaughter and the aggravated assault are running concurrent and not consecutive. So just wanted to put that on record. Just for any further questions for the distinguished attorney? Have none. And I'm going to let you decide who will come first. I'm not going to get into that one. You can tell me who's coming first. So anybody who wants to come, you can invite them in the order that you would like.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Michael London, spelled L-O-N-D-O-N. I'm the vice president of the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association. My organization and its membership have supported Richard Crisman since the beginning of the incident that leads us here today. As the board is aware, Richard did not commit a wanton criminal act. Richard was acting within the scope of his duties, dealing with a domestic violence suspect that was found to be on methamphetamine and had applied the continuum of force as he was trained to do. Richard's sentence is excessive in comparison to shorter sentences received by other officers across the country who were also acting within the scope of duty. These officers had similar convictions or convictions for greater crimes. A few examples of these officers from across the country are: in 2010, an Oakland, California officer was convicted of involuntary manslaughter and received a two-year sentence, serving only 11 months of that sentence. In 2013, an Oklahoma officer was convicted of first-degree manslaughter and received a four-year sentence. In 2013, a Virginia officer was convicted of voluntary manslaughter and received a three-year sentence. And in 2014, a Texas officer was convicted of second-degree manslaughter and was given 5 years probation, never serving a day. The actual day-to-day time that Richard has to serve is unduly severe because of his status and the requirements of protective custody, which leaves him a great distance from his family, and means at the very least that there is that degree of confinement and the fear of his actual status in the prison. I would ask that you please consider these things in this process for Richard to be granted the privilege that he seeks. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, board members? No questions for board members. Thank you so very much, Mr. Linda.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the board. Thank you for letting me come here and address you today. I had to scribble some stuff off given what was previously said.
Would you please state your name just for the record, sir?
My name's Albert Buffa.
Thank you, sir.
My last name is spelled B-U-F-F-A. I'm an 18-year veteran police officer, also former partner of Richard Crisman. I'd like to touch a little bit on the fact that I know that the plea was brought up. Just a little bit of the treatment initially. I speak to Rich often. He was able to relate a lot of information to me. And I've learned a lot of information of what it is like to be a police officer and be taken into custody. When Rich was originally taken from us back in September of 2013, he was immediately taken into custody in the courtroom. And the phone calls were hard to get through at that point. It put all of us on a, I guess you can say, a different experience than what we're used to in my profession. When he was taken into custody and I was able to finally talk to him, let me tell you kind of how his day was and how it works with the MCSO jail system and the court. Because of his profession, he had 23 hours inside a confined cell. He had 1 hour to try and make phone calls. He had that same hour to try and take care of his personal hygiene and walk any distance other than maybe 4 feet by 4 feet from his cell. He had court appearances during this time. and that was on his mind, and it was still unknown what he was going to do. When you have, when you're in MCSO custody, and in protective custody, Rich would get waken up at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. He would be transferred to a different holding room where they prepare for people to be transported to the courthouse. Once at the courthouse, again, another holding room until your court appearance. After the court appearance, you're there all day long until the evening time after court closed in order to go back to the facility. Being transported back to the facility, he wouldn't get back to his cell until 11 o'clock at night. It's, imagine going through multiple days of having to appear in court and getting just a few hours sleep a night with that type of treatment. A plea was offered. He was in a bad place, minimal sleep, constantly being woken up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, not getting back till 11, and even if he could even sleep at that point. Anyway, that's in the past. He took the plea. From there, he remained in MCSO custody until an agreement was drawn up and he was transported out of state. This agreement was supposed to be in order for him to have some sort of regular treatment as any other inmate, because he was constantly in a cell 23 hours a day, allowed out once for 1 hour to try and walk, call, do take care of his personal hygiene. When he got transferred, unbeknown to all of us, he actually remained in protective custody, which was not part of the deal that he thought he was going to get. He remained at this facility until other arrangements could be made. Again, at this facility, 23 hours a day in a confined cell, 1 hour out to make phone calls and to exercise and to take care of his hygiene. This remained like this for just under 2 years until there was finally a different facility that he could be brought to. Upon transferring to that facility, like Ms. Cassells had already previously stated, it's not the same rules as if he was here in the state of Arizona. I won't go over those again in detail, but you can't have contact visits. Arizona DOC even allows in certain times a picnic where multiple visitors can come in and outside food can be brought in coolers. None of that's allowed there. Family and friends who are able to go visit him have to drive 10 plus hours to go see him for maybe a 1 or 2 hour visit. And that's not always guaranteed because of things happening at the facility that he's at. That's not even guaranteed for the future. There's talks even at this facility of going to video conferencing, which would still have the visitor traveling 10 plus hours to go up there for 1 or 2 hours, and you don't even get to see him in person through plexiglass. I personally think it's horrible treatment. Rich has served harsher sentencing than any other regular inmate. And I ask that the board takes this into consideration when deciding whether or not to move forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so very much. Any questions, board members? I see no questions from board members. Thanks again, Mr. Buckley. Who's next, supporters?
A-L-F-I-E-R.
Good morning and welcome to the board.
Thank you for listening here. I'm a second cousin to Richard. I'm here today to ask for his clemency, but I want to tell a little story real quick. But at the time of all this incident happened in 2010, there was a lot of unrest in the Southmont precinct where Richard was working. There was a councilman that was a black councilman that was arrested or dropped to his knees in his home by two white police officers. At the time, the community was outraged. There was a lot of unrest there, and I think they were out for police officers. They were just, and of course, Richard was a white officer, and I think they used him as a scapegoat in this case. I mean, I don't think he had any malicious intent that day. I think he was just doing his job. And I, for one, appreciate that he was there to protect and serve as a police officer. And I think he's been away a long time from his family, his friends, his wife, his children. And that day in court, he did appear very cold-hearted, but I think what he did is he was speaking from the heart and he spoke the facts. It's like, I think you can only do that if you have no evil in your heart, or if you can't, you know, you don't stutter or speak, you ask the questions, you answer them. And I think that's what he did, and I think he's paid his price for being a police officer, something he's loved. He'll never go back to that career. He'll never go back to the life he had. He has suffered immensely for his actions that day under the course of the law. He was a police officer. And I don't feel he was judged by a jury of his peers. He was judged by a jury of regular people. If there was 12 police officers on that panel that had been in similar situations, they would understand where his action came from, where what was happening. And I think that would be the judgment would have been different for him if that would have been the case. And so I asked the panel to please consider clemency for Richard Christman. And thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions by board members? I hear no questions coming from board members. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ronald Kevern, K-E-V-E-R-N.
Thanks for being here this morning, sir.
Thank you. I'm an 84-year-old man whose father was a police officer. And when I reviewed the case, I read it every day in the paper to see what was going on, and read the sentence and felt, wow, harsh sentence. I believe it was a harsh sentence. I know his family has struggled because of the distance they must travel. I'm here to support them and to support to break the sentence down to a lesser time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions, board members? I hear no questions from board members.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, sir.
Sir, we now have Maria Christman.
Good morning. My name is Maria Christman.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Maria, I'm here in name of my husband. He has always been a man who gives, does, and follows his heart. His dedication during the 10 years that he was a police officer to the people who needed him, who wanted him. That specific day of October 5th, 2010, he wasn't not even supposed to be in the place where he was. But he followed what he was, his career, his dream, his job. That day, he was coming back from training. He can easily go home, relax, pop a beer, sit on a couch, watch TV. He didn't. He went back to his prison. On his way back, he responded that call, who never, ever anyone else wanted to do it. They all know what responding to a domestic violence call means. During the last 4 years, 108 officers had died. Thousands more had been attacked without a reason, with the only purpose of hurting them, showing them that they don't have value for the person who they are protecting and serving. They put their lives in risk. They do what they have to do to go back home to the family. My husband hasn't been back home for 37 years, as I can say. Because the day after the incident, when he went back home, my husband wasn't there. He was a shell of the man who was the day before. The man hasn't been the same one since that day. All he did was his job. All he wanted to do was his job. The job that he was trained to do and was told to do, the way he was told to do. Until this day, I cannot say is a price that he's paying, but he doesn't regret going to go to work that day. He doesn't regret doing what he has to do to go back to his house. The only thing he regrets is not could have done more than what he did. What I mean by more is all the questions he has in the back of his head. Could have done something different. Could have just walk away and stay outside. And, you know, let somebody else do the job. Unfortunately, anyone else did want to do that job that day. And now, the many police officers, they don't want to answer that call. Why? They don't want to be in my husband's shoes. They don't want to be in a casket. My heart hurts for all those wives, but they don't have their husbands anymore. I can tell you that my husband will be back home. The man who I love, I still support, and I will always be behind. He will be back home. He will not be the same one, but he will be back home. To his family, and try to get back his two sons who were took away from him the moment he was taken custody. Two sons who at the day they are 16 and 18 years old, growing without a father, going to college, doing their lives. Two boys who they have not had one time sitting next to each other in this last 4 years to know what they have changed, what the questions a boy has for a father. I have daughters. My daughter, who is a 12-year-old right now, asked me, why was this fair and how was this fair for her at 8 years old, be without a dad? I do understand that I'm not fair. It's not easy. But if I can say, and you don't take me wrong in this way, is I don't regret my husband took the decision he took to go back to his family that day, alive. All I hope is that you can see far than just the things that they are saying in this room, and look deep in your heart and to try to understand if it's something can be done different than what was done in court. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Board members, any questions? I hear no questions from board members. Thanks again.
My name is Kim Owens.
Welcome.
My father was a Phoenix police officer from the time I was 9 for 27 years. My husband also served as a Phoenix police officer for 27 years. Being the daughter or the wife of a police officer is all I have known for the last 50 years of my life. What you just heard Maria Christman speak of is what we have lived every day. As a child, I would go to sleep under my cross praying, thinking that if I kept praying, my dad would be safe and come home. Rich Christman went to work that day knowing that his job was to come home. I thank God every day that my husband retired and he came home to his family. If you go back to the time that this incident occurred, it was not a normal time. Mr. Chairman, you used the word severe. It was a very severe time in Phoenix. We had racial unrest in South Phoenix. We had a chief who was looking to hold on to a job. We had a race for county attorney underway. And what we had was a circus of a trial called Jody Arias. This fell on the heels of that at a time when the public was ginned up for more blood and more excitement and a National Enquirer mentality everywhere. Rich Christman should never have been arrested. When the homicide reports came out, when the drug reports came out, if you look at the facts of this trial, it should never have happened. The severity started the night he was arrested, and it continued to this day when he is housed in what you've heard described as something much more severe than anybody else should ever have to endure for the same sentence. When he was handed that plea deal, all of that was going on. You cannot take it in the vacuum of today and escape what was happening at that point in time when he made that plea deal. When the entire Phoenix Police Department was being put on trial and they were all called out for bad behavior, he was protecting more than himself and his family. He was standing up as a man of honor at that time. It was a severe thing that was going on. And I ask you to look at that in the entirety, and I ask you to be gracious and grant this clemency. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Do you have any questions?
Questions, board members.
Thank you
so very much.
Good morning, members of the board.
Good morning, sir.
My name is Robert Christman, spelled the same as Mr. Officer Richard. I'm Richard's older brother. Growing up with Richard was always a challenge. I never in a million years would have thought this would happen to such a wonderful person. He was always on my heels to keep me out of trouble. And it was weird because I was the older brother. I was the one supposed to be getting into trouble so that they could learn from my mistakes. But instead, I was being schooled by my little brother on how not to. And I can remember that day in October 2010. I was up on top of a mountain with a rifle chasing a bear. And I got a phone call from my mother, and I got upset because my phone just kept blowing up in my pocket. And I thought, it's got to be important. And when I answered the phone, my mother said to me, have you heard from your brother? And I said, no, why? She said, I got a phone call, something's wrong. I said, what did the phone call say? She said, it was your brother, he said. I just want you to know, you did not raise a monster. We knew that. I know who my brother is. And I almost feel like I let him down. I think that the sentence that he has been handed is far more than what should have happened. I think that him responding to that call was his nature to protect. He responded to that call because of who he is, not because of his job, not because his duties called him to do it. He didn't have to. He did it because of who he is, the protector. One who always protected me, who always protected his baby sister. He didn't have to, but he did. And I think that 23 hours a day in solitary confinement is enough to change anybody. And sometimes it's not a good change. I know that the distance that I have to travel to see him makes it very difficult, and to be quite honest, I've seen him twice in the last 4 years because of the distance and the cost. I speak to him weekly on the telephone for 15 minutes because that's what he's allowed. My little brother's not a criminal. My little brother chases criminals. My little brother took a job to protect him because that's who he was. I don't feel that any of this ever should have. But it did. What I do know is that we're lost without him. We miss him dearly. And it makes it so difficult that he's so far away. And to know that he has to be treated a certain way because of who he was. He has to be kept away from any contact because of who he was. So every day or every week when he calls me, I start the conversation with, how are you holding up? You know, how are you holding up? How's that any way to start a conversation with a family? How are you holding up as if somebody died or something? I don't know what else to say except I want my little brother home. And I don't think this is where it will happen to him. And I ask you guys to please consider his clemency. Please consider reducing the sentence so that we can see him once again. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Question, board members? There are no questions. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sarah Wilkinson, W-I-L-K-I-N-S-O-N. I've been a longtime friend of Rich for 18 years now. We had our children pretty much together, same age. And what is so severe about his sentencing is being, when he was sentenced out of state, at that time he had 50-50 custody of his children. The mother took that opportunity when he was moved to move his children. And as you know, custody fights are one thing, but to be incarcerated and out of state is another. This has led to him only being able to see his children one time since being incarcerated because of the distance that he is and that she moved. His children are now almost adults. They speak to my kids all the time, and they do express a want and need to come back and be with their father. I think the soonest that we can do that, the better. So I would also ask for your consideration in this clemency.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions, board members? Thank you so very much.
Yes. My name's Nancy Spinner and Richard Christensen. Give me a minute, please. Forgive me if I repeat things because I have a hearing issue and I don't hear what everybody's saying. So what I'm asking, I'm not gonna go through anything that I feel the court has messed up. Yeah. What I'm gonna try to do is to explain to you what my son is. My son has always, since a wee child, done for other people. That's what made him happy. He loved doing for people. He wanted to help people. When he became a cop, it just about shattered me because, well, what mother wants a son to become a cop? At first it's fun, but it's scary. So whenever there was an incident in Phoenix, if I live up north, that involved a cop, my son would shoot me a text or a call and say, real quick, I'm fine, which meant it's, you know, I'm okay, Mom, I'm not involved, or whatever. On October 10th, I got a text. That text read, I'm fine, Mom, I'm walking, I'm not in the hospital, but don't watch the news. As it continued, I'm like, don't watch the news, but as it continued, or he sent another one, he says, Mom, you raised a good son. I am not a monster. And at that point, I knew something happened, and I couldn't find anything, because that was the day of the big hailstorm, where nothing on the news was nothing. I mean, everything on the news was nothing but the hailstorm. I couldn't find out what was going on with my son. When I did, when I finally found out, we got down, and I found out that he wasn't just an officer-involved shooting, which scared me from day one, but that he had been arrested for going to the one thing that he always told me, domestic violence is the worst when it comes to a police officer, because you never know what's going to happen. To be arrested to go because he went on a call and had that split second to do what he thought he had to do. When my son came out of jail, his smile, his laugh, this child that would walk in the room and light up the room because he just had that personality that, you know, he loves you. Whether you know it or not, he loves you. Was shattered. I mean, I thought I had lost him forever, you know, into a total depression. I was afraid for his life. I was afraid he was going to, you know, not that he, I'm sorry, I'm getting, not that he was, what broke him is the fact that he had to shoot somebody. Not that he'd been arrested, that he knows he had, that goes along, but that he took somebody's life, and he'd wake up during, I lived with him at the time, and I would hear him screaming, waking up at night screaming from the nightmares. He's gotten over those nightmares for the most part. He still has them. But my son, when I call him or when I see him, he still is that, I'm putting you first, Mom. How you doing? Guess what happened today in my cell? I watched the paint peel. But he does it with the personality he's trying to do for me. He's done for everybody all his life to make them happy. He's not a criminal. He's not, he should not be behind bars. Take his job away, yes, that would make me happy, not him. But to put him behind bars for doing his job, no. And I'm asking you to correct the wrongdoing to him that was done. It's up to you, and I know it's up to other people, and it's up to the governor, but you're the first step. And I'm asking you to please pass this on to the next step, but that'd be your favor. Bring him home to us, let him walk into a room and light up the room again. Everybody that's in this room can tell you when he walked in the room, he would light it up. He had that personality. The first time I saw my son in jail was in chains from the ankles to his hands and feet were chained together. He had a collar and a spit mask on. The worst thing my entire life I could think of that I thought was to see that destroyed. How do you see that? How do you do this? He's not a mass murderer. He's not a serial killer. He's never done anything to hurt anybody outside of one split second ruling. Please correct the wrong that was done to him. I'm not going to go on because I'm getting confused again, but I'm asking you to forgive me for that too. It's, as a parent, I'm sure that you can all understand that I could go on for days telling about my kid. I have two of them sitting here that's the most awesome in the world. And I have one that's just as awesome that needs to come home. He needs to come home to his children, his wife. He's got two stepdaughters that just absolutely adore him. He's not their stepdad. He's their dad. He's got two boys that miss him terribly. He's got a wife that stood by him from day one. He's got friends out there that's just... The world revolves around him, as far as they're concerned, you know, as far as I'm concerned. Our world right now revolves around you guys. And I thank you for listening.
Thank you so very much for coming. And board members, do you have any questions? Thank you.
Is there anyone else?
I'd like to ask, can you? I'd like to thank the board for having me here. My name is Chance Tressler. I am Richard Christman's nephew.
Welcome, sir.
There's one thing that I want to say is that his character stood out. If you were lost and you were going into a grocery store and you were very uncomfortable with your situation, Richard would either notice that and help you, or you would feel very comfortable in your approach to asking for help. I can see that this is affecting a lot of people, but everyone in this room has greatly appreciated him. I think that if we all put it together, that we could really make the wrong right. And I do see that all of you have connected with every person that has spoken, and you have really taken into consideration what's been said. And one thing that I do believe would help is empathy, the ability to take ourselves out of our own shoes and into someone else's shoes. And if I was to put myself into my uncle's shoes, I would realize the cards that have been dealt to me are not exactly fair. I don't really know what else to say, but thank you.
Thank you so much, sir. Question, board members? Thank you.
Yes. I believe that's all from the family and friends who are present today.
Okay, thank you, Attorney. And as I stated earlier, we will give you an opportunity to make a final statement at the end. So at this point, we will go to either the state or the victims. I don't know who wants to come first, the county attorney's office or the victims. Who wants to come first? Please come forward, sir. Please state your name again, just for the record, sir.
My name is Juan Martinez, and I'm the prosecutor in this particular case.
Welcome, sir.
Good morning. I remember that seeing the case, and one of the things that we did was that you get the explanation of what it was that happened out there, and you don't at that point have the police report, but you have a narration or a statement from the others that were there telling you exactly what happened. And one of the things that we were told was what actually happened out there, according to another police officer. You've told, well, police officers face this all the time. Richard Christmas was not alone that day. He was with another police officer, Sergio Virgello, who did not pull his gun and who did not fire. But in looking at this, one of the things that we looked at and considered, and I considered all this, in deciding whether or not to go forward, because if it's something that's an isolated incident, if it's something that it's out of character and somehow was justified, then of course I'm not going to file charges. But one of the things that we did, and one of the things we considered, is we looked at his background. You've been told, and the reason why I'm addressing it is because you've been told he's a peaceable person, that this was out of character, that this was the one and only event that had ever happened. Except that there's a video out there. And there's a video that shows Mr. Christman, because he's not a police officer anymore, that shows Mr. Christman before this happened, down here off of 7th Avenue in Jefferson. And it just so happened that somebody at the medical office of the medical examiner was monitoring the video and recorded what happened. Officer Christman and two other officers with the Phoenix Police Department stopped the woman. And when they talked to her, for whatever reason that they were talking to her, they stood there. And at one point, the decision was made by these officers, Mr. Christman included, that they were going to plant evidence on this particular woman. And it's on video. That's available for everyone to see. And I saw it. As this woman is held by a female police officer, Mr. Christman is seen going to the trunk of his car to get what turned out to perhaps be drug paraphernalia. We don't know exactly what it was. As the woman is standing there being held by the female police officer, Mr. Christman goes behind her and gives her something in the back. And then this female police officer plants it on what is now a victim, a person that they stopped to talk to. So when they stop, when they tell you that this is an isolated incident, and if we're going to look at those sorts of things, that's one of the things that I ask you to consider. It wasn't an isolated incident. In my view, as a prosecutor at that point, he violated his oath to protect the citizenry when he planted that evidence. Perhaps they thought it was funny. Perhaps, and I know that the person that they did this to didn't think it was funny because she started spitting and struggling. So it escalated the situation. So I do not think that looking at the situation and hearing from these individuals, we can turn our back and not consider the whole individual. But to go back to the incident that I was reviewing on that day, what we were able to determine was that the mother of this person, the decedent, called the police, and it was a domestic violence situation. The mother and the son had a problem. Whatever the problem was, there was an argument. And at that point, she called the police and went to a trailer that was next door. Two officers responded, Richard Christman and Sergio Virgillo. When they got there, they went inside the trailer. When they went inside the trailer, inside was the victim, shirtless. And as he stood there, yes, he cursed. And you can guess what the words were, but when he said, do you have a warrant? It wasn't just a warrant, he was describing it in a guttural sense. Do you have a warrant? And Mr. Christman responded in kind, just as gutturally, but with a little action, took out his gun, slammed it to this left temple of this individual and said, I have your warrant right here. That's the aggravated assault charge. And when the medical examiner opened the head up of this decedent, he noticed that there was bruising there. So it wasn't like it was just a mild touching. It wasn't just like it was a situation where he didn't even touch them. He actually applied enough force so that there was bleeding underneath the skull. And that comprised the aggravated assault charge. It's not just the murder that we're talking about. There were two charges, an aggravated assault, and there was a second degree murder charge. The situation escalated at that point so that a taser was used. The taser did not seem to affect him, and it appears, and no one's quite certain why, but it appears because it did not, both prongs did not strike the victim so that they could have the full effect, and so that the situation continued. At one point, everybody kind of backed off, and then that's when the victim had his hands up. Sort of a supplicant kind of position. Had his hands up, had it up, stepping backwards. At that point, Mr. Christman had already stuck the gun in his head and had shown that he wasn't quite the officer that's being presented here. Officers do not, just because we as officers have a badge, do not have the right to curse at somebody and say, I've got your so-and-so warrant right here, and slam somebody on the side of the head. That's not something that can be condoned. And then the other thing is, at that point, this person's defenseless. Doesn't have a shirt on, just standing there with his hands up. And then that's when Mr. Christman fires one shot. The victim turns, and then Mr. Christman fires another shot, sort of to the side, in the back, and kills him. And that's the situation that you are here to decide about. There was a jury, and it was a jury of 12 individuals. And that jury of 12 individuals decided that Mr. Christman was guilty of the aggravated assault charge. And I bore you with that, or I mentioned that, because the sentence for an aggravated assault charge, the one that the jury convicted him of, was a minimum of 5 years a presumptive sentence of 7.5 years and a maximum of 15 years. If he would have been convicted of the murder in the second degree, his sentence would have been 10 to 22 years. So once being convicted of that, the presumptive was 7.5 years. What we're talking about in this case, he pled guilty to a manslaughter and was given a mitigated term of 7 years. So it's not even the presumptive term that we're talking about. So when we're talking about whether or not this sentence was excessive, that it was too much, one point of reference that we can use is the sentencing chart. And the sentencing chart that tells you that, not even for the aggravated assault, is it even the presumptive. It's less than the presumptive. I understand that for him it may seem like a lifetime, but to the legislators, the people that put the sentencing chart together for an aggravated assault, it's not even the presumptive, it's a mitigated term. So when you go back to make your decision, or when you consider this, if you do it out here, one of the things that I ask you to keep in mind is the sentencing structure, which indicates that this individual got a break. He got a break when he was only sentenced to 7 years for violating somebody's life, taking that. And in addition to that, it was more than that. It was violating the public trust. And then in this day and age, when we talk about police officers getting away with things, we've seen riots on television, we've seen issues with police officers shooting at other individuals. This is one individual that is being held accountable. And now they're asking you, well, don't hold him so accountable. Don't hold him too accountable. Because after all, he's already suffered. Well, he took a life. And he took this life when he was wearing the blue of the Phoenix Police Department. And that is a violation of a fiduciary duty. And because it is a mitigated term, I ask that you deny the request. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Questions, board members? Any questions from board members? And the victim's wishes to...
I should note that the victim intended to be here. And I wrote a letter indicating that. For whatever reason, we got notified, we being the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, was under the impression that this was rescheduled to Monday. Therefore, she couldn't be here. Her comments would be that she would oppose this commutation, that although she did have a situation where she had this confrontation with her son, it's somebody that she misses dearly, and she believes that this is a situation that should never have happened. Thank you.
I did have a question.
We do have a question from Mr. Kiwanis.
Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman. Just a quick follow-up question. You did make reference to a past incident, and I know that that's not what we're here for.
Correct.
Were charges brought up on that case, and did that evidence surface?
I requested that this be used. Well, one of the things that happened is that Mr. Crisman took the witness stand, and I believe that that incident impacted or should be heard by the jury, because it was an incident where he was being untruthful. If you are planting evidence on somebody, that's an incident that indicates that you are being untruthful. So the judge, I brought it up and asked the judge whether or not I could use it or question him at the trial. The judge's ruling was that it was too prejudicial and I could not use it. There was an internal investigation by the Phoenix Police Department, and they made their finding. I believe that that's sealed, so I don't know how far I can go with it.
Okay. But, thank you.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate that, because I guess my point is, if you're going to make reference to that, the question I'm going to ask the board member, not an attorney, not a judge, is what evidence? But if it's sealed, you've told us what you can, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And just ask this.
Sure.
County attorney, sir. We've had reference already to the plea agreement. From your perspective, how did we end up with that plea agreement? What happened? Was he forced into it, or was it his own free will in the court? How did we end up with a plea agreement?
What happened with regard to the plea agreement, and I can't speak for him, so I'll be somewhat cautious in my comments, but it was a plea agreement that was worked out between his attorney and the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. As I've already indicated, the presumptive term, what he was already facing because he had already been convicted, was a 7.5 year term. The agreement that was entered into reflected that he was going to go to prison anyway. And so it was a situation like any other defendant. There was a give and take on both sides, and then a plea was extended and he entered into. Of course, it was given to his lawyer, and I am certain that he discussed it with his lawyer.
Thank you, sir. Any further questions, board members? I don't see any further questions. Thank you so much, sir. Let me ask once again, is there anyone else here on behalf of the victim? I ask the second time and a third time. No one else is here. As I indicated up front, that this time we would have closing statements coming from the offender's attorney. Please come forward and state your name again for the record, ma'am.
Very good. Julia Castle, CASSCLS, agent for Richard Chrisman. The board has had an opportunity now to hear from various colleagues, family members, friends who have spoken about the severity of the sentence, both as it is imposed and both as it is, in effect, being executed. Mr. Martinez, who prosecuted this case and who handled the trial in this matter, chose to bring up today an earlier incident that involves alleged misconduct that was investigated by Internal Affairs and is now sealed. That testimony was prevented from being used during the course of the trial for legal reasons because it was found to be too prejudicial. And now Mr. Martinez informs us that matter is in fact sealed. I am asking the board to disregard any of that information as presented. We do not have sufficient detail, nor is that an area in which we should be going into. In terms of the plea agreement, Mr. Chrisman had sat through over 3 weeks of trial. The jury hung as to the second-degree murder charge. The jury could not reach a unanimous decision as is required to render a verdict. When a jury comes back and informs the court that they can't reach a verdict, the court typically gives an instruction, basically asking them to see if they can perhaps contemplate further, if they can come to a unanimous agreement. They could not in this case, and so a mistrial was declared. I believe it is at that point, which Mr. Martinez, knowing he had just in effect not gotten the conviction that he was so sure he was about to get, elected to offer a plea to a lower level, to drop it from a second degree murder down to the manslaughter charge. There is no indication that Mr. Chrisman was forced. There is no indication. We are not arguing that whatsoever. He took that plea completely voluntarily and of his own free will. Was he under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure? Certainly. I would argue that any defendant signing a plea is under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. However, it is different for someone who is former law enforcement because of the custodial conditions which have been described here to you today. Mr. Martinez also makes much of the fact that, well, the presumptive term is actually something more. In Arizona sentencing schematics, the judge is to start at the presumptive term and then balance aggravators, bad stuff, versus mitigators, the good stuff. And specific findings are required to be made to justify a mitigated sentence. Judge Granville did that in this case. He indicated he had found one aggravating factor, which was emotional harm to the victim's family. He, however, found four mitigating factors. Number one was family and community support, including that of former colleagues. Number two, evidence showed the use of the gun was an immediate reaction to the suspect's aggression. Number three, Mr. Chrisman used the use of force protocols as trained by the Phoenix Police Department. Number four, the actions that Mr. Chrisman took were subjectively reasonable. Those four factors, Judge Granville found significantly outweighed the aggravating factor and justified that sentence. It is important to note in Judge Granville's letter that he wrote specifically for this proceeding, and I'm reading from the middle of the page, "As I mentioned at the time of sentencing, I would have imposed a less harsh sentence had the law allowed. As I mentioned at the time of sentencing and believed to have been proven true, Mr. Christman's period of incarceration would be much more restrictive than other inmates convicted of the same offense. The judge goes on to say, while it is tragic, the victim lost his life. Those actions were caused by a good faith, subjective belief of justification. A good faith justification. I am asking the board to consider everything that we've heard here today, to contemplate the treatment in the investigations and prosecutions of other police officers, both here in Maricopa County and across the nation, which are covered on almost a daily basis in the news, to consider the very unique nature of Mr. Christman's incarceration, and finally, the words of Judge Warren Granville, as he has committed to the letters to provide to y'all today. I am hopeful that the board will choose to move forward on this. I do believe this is a very deserving case. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. At this time, the board will...
Mr. Chairman, before we conclude, I just want to clear something up.
Yes, sir. Please go ahead, sir.
The PSB investigation by the City of Phoenix, which I was asked by Board Member Quinones, I don't know if it's sealed or not, but in the abundance of caution, I believe that it's sealed, so I chose not to speak about the investigation. But the incident itself and the videotape that's involved in that is a matter of public record. So that's the distinction I wanted to make.
Thank you so very much,
sir. Thank you, sir.
At this time, the board will prepare to go into discussion. As I indicated up front, that each board member votes independent of each other. The board members have not had an opportunity to discuss this case among themselves. This will be the first time sitting right here in the public under the Arizona open meeting law. This board will have had an opportunity to discuss this case and to make a determination. I would also just acknowledge the fact that, as was brought up by the attorney earlier, this board will adhere to the fact that it will not reveal publicly or privately the whereabouts of the of Mr. Christman. This is something that this board will not do at all. Just wanted to make that very clear. The board, in this discussion, it may sound as if we're talking to you, those who are somewhat here, but we're not. We're just talking among ourselves, and we're going to ask that everyone would remain quiet. After this discussion, the board will make its decision, its determination, sitting right here. We'll not go back into a secret closet to make our determination. We will vote as independent board members based upon what we've heard, what each individual board member's heard, each board member's read, in terms of the documentation presented to the board. At this time, the board is going into discussion. Is there a board member who wishes to lead off the discussion at this time? Honorable Mr. Kiwanis, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman. This is going to be an interesting discussion, and I want to begin this as a discussion. I find these types of criminal cases difficult and tragic in as much that even with video, a camera angle does not always perceive as the officer perceives a deadly threat in the context of situational awareness, and this is by no means a justification of excessive force or an illegal act. All I'm saying is they're challenging, controversial cases. I wish to say that I find the judge's letter meaningful, but herein lies the challenge, and that is that Mr. Christman was given the minimum sentence. There was no lower sentence, which is why I know there was talk about aggravating and mitigating. What I was asking earlier is there are some charges in which there's actually mitigated minimum presumptive maximum and aggravated. So, look, there's five choices. There's lower and higher choices. And it would seem in this case that that Mr. Crisman was given the minimum sentence, even though the judge was not necessarily comfortable with the sentencing guidelines. And again, that's not to speak for the judge, that's just the way I perceive it from the letter. What I'm taking into consideration right now is whether or not it is excessive in the context of the above and beyond piece of Mr. Crisman's sentence, in as much as he's serving off-site, protective custody conditions, which is, I believe, is punishment above and beyond the minimum sentence, especially considering his positive behavior as an inmate, and that's based on the information that we have within Ames. So I was careful not to get into locations, but I'm just, that's where I'm beginning the discussion. Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman.
Thank you so very much, sir. Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse?
Yes, Mr. Chair. In all the materials I read, and I'm not a trained police officer, but I have limited training in use of force. It looked to me like that day he performed exactly as he was trained to do. It seemed to me. And when you're faced with somebody who's on meth, it can be very unpredictable. Things don't faze them. Possibly he could have been tased and not fazed by that either. So, you know, I'm weighing the danger that somebody faces going into an unknown situation and having to respond. And it appears to me, as one member of this board, that he responded as he was trained to do. And you need to weigh that with, there was a victim in this crime. Someone died. And I can't get past that. On the other side, Mr. Crisman lost a career that he loved. A career, a life. We have the letter from Judge Granville, who himself believes the sentence was excessive. You know, I don't know that he used that word. He said he would have imposed less harsh sentence had the law allowed. So he didn't use the word excessive, but he said less harsh. He believes the sentence imposed in this matter is unduly harsh. So this is my contribution to this discussion, and I'll be interested to hear other points of view.
Thank you so much, Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse. Honorable Mr. Neal?
Without retrying the case, going back to, you know, what the jury found, what the judge found, what the plea agreement was, first I would like to note that they used the reasonable person standard, at least within the department, for, you know, determining excessive force. The one thing I found in my career is that a reasonable person is not a fixed quantity that you can just pull out of a hat and say, this is what a reasonable person is. There are people considering everything, decide what's reasonable in their eyes. And the point of that is that with two officers in the same room, the same suspect, one can feel very threatened by the situation and the other will not feel threatened at all. And with what I read from the report, the other officer did not feel a threat. But that person can't speak for the other officer because they're not the same perspective, the same position, thinking the same and everything else. But my big thing is that the sentence is not excessive based on the law and the way the crimes are sentenced and everything. But, and I know this from personal experience, from having somebody incarcerated for manslaughter, that he is restricted to something that only prisoners on total maximum security are normally subjected to. This person that I know that went through second degree murder had free reign like any other prisoner, medium security, could get out of cells, interact with other people, everything else like that. And that is a tremendous thing. And if you look at things like Senator McCain's torture in Vietnam, part of the torture with those people was to isolate them for very long periods of time where nobody, even the guards, would talk to them. And that is unduly harsh, in my opinion. So I personally think at this point in time that, that the 7 years is a little bit too harsh, too excessive, when you consider the type of incarceration that the person has to go through. And it's not just because of the, you know, that kind of treatment is there because of the police officer. But the law doesn't require that for anybody else that's convicted of the same crime and sentenced to the same amount of years, presumptive of the minimum, whatever. They're treated solely different. Even sex offenders and child abuse offenders aren't normally put in that 23 hours in and 1 hour out. They're isolated, but they're isolated with other prisoners of a like nature. So two sex offenders can't go out in the general population, excuse me, but they're not isolated in a cell by themselves for 23 hours out a day and only taken out at 1 o'clock in the morning to exercise or 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever the schedule relates. So in that basis, I do, as one voting board member, I do think that the sentence itself is excessive and that we should move forward with the phase two.
Thank you so much, Mr. Neal. I think that I've heard from my colleagues, I think that we do recognize the fact that the sentences were just a couple of things before we vote. There were two offenses, the manslaughter and the aggravated assault. And at the end of the day, the court agreed that they would be concurrent rather than consecutive, because they could have easily been consecutive and that would have added on additional years. But the court made that determination at that point that they were not excessive. I think that we've heard today from all sides, I believe, and I've heard from my colleagues, and I appreciate their patience and their being in a position to share with all of us their concerns and their opinions. And with that being said, rather than procrastinating, because based upon the information that's been presented to the board and based upon information that documents as well as discussion by board members at this time, I think that I would just make a motion and we'll see where it goes. And the motion would be to pass to phase two. And that is the motion.
Second.
Agreed.
Who seconded that?
I did, sir.
Okay, thank you, sir. A unanimous determination of the board will be passed to phase two. And sometime in the future, we do not have a calendar date at this time, a phase two hearing will be held. The phase two hearing, as I've indicated right up front, will take under consideration everything. It will not be as limited as we are here today. Therefore, this will end the hearing. Thank all of you for your participation, and we will be back at phase two at some time in the future. Thank you, and the hearing is over. Board members, we'll take a 5 minutes recess.
Thank you, sir.